Public health experts have a message this week. The pandemic is not over yet. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we'll tell you why the virus is still so active here in Florida. Give us a call now. It's 549-2937. Then later, the pandemic has sparked a housing crisis. But this weekend, the city will provide an opportunity to let renters know they have rights. First, though, the latest numbers on the pandemic. The state reports that COVID cases increased overnight by nearly 6,000. Hospitalizations ticked up by a couple of dozen, and so did deaths. The death toll in the state now stands at 33,822. At the same time, 6.6 million Florida residents have gotten at least one dose of a vaccine, so that's some good news. But here's the thing, everyone. Nearly half of new coronavirus infections nationwide are in just five states. And you guessed it, Florida is one of those five. It's a situation putting pressure on the federal government to consider changing how it distributes vaccines by sending more doses to hotspots. We're a hotspot. Not only that, a highly contagious and more deadly variant of COVID-19 is also actively spreading across the state. In fact, we have more cases of this variant than almost any other state. It is the dominant form of the virus now. This is concerning. We want to get an update, and we're pleased to welcome back a local expert. He's Chad Nielsen, Director of Accreditation and Infection Prevention at UF Health Jacksonville. Hi, Chad.
Hi, good morning.
So good to have you back on the show at this timely moment in fighting the pandemic. What are your questions about the variant spreading across Florida, everyone, and how the government is responding, and local and state officials too? It's 549-2937 as we talk about this. It's called the B117 variant. 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. And our Facebook page, as always, is open to you. So, Chad, nearly half of the new virus infections are in five states, including Florida, along with New York, Michigan, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. That's alarming. At the same time, this variant that's spreading around the state is now the dominant form of the virus. And actually, there's more than one variant. But can you explain to us what the state of affairs is now with the spread of the virus in Florida and what your biggest concerns are?
Yeah, sure can, Melissa, and thanks for having me on. So currently right now, as you have already stated, we're averaging somewhere north of 5,000 new cases of COVID-19 in Florida per day, amounting to somewhere around an average of 7% positivity. So of all tests every day, roughly 7% are coming back positive for any strain of COVID-19. Across Florida, the average age is hovering around 35. So what that indicates is that it's a younger, more mobile, more active crowd that are starting to become positive for COVID-19, which is what we expected. We began this rollout of the vaccine targeting those who were in an age group that could lead to more severe disease. So the 65 mm-hmm. and ups have largely been getting their vaccines, and so now the cases are starting to shift lower. Here in the local area in Duval County, our average age of new cases is also around 34, 35 years old. We're averaging somewhere around 100 new cases per day in Duval County alone, and our percent positivity is somewhere around 4.5. But that varies. Clay County yesterday had a percent positivity of almost 8, which is very high versus what we've been seeing. So the virus is still very active around Florida, of course, and here in Duval and the local metro counties as well.
Okay. And can you explain why public health experts such as yourself are concerned about this more deadly, contagious variant of the virus, which is now the dominant virus in Florida? And in fact, Florida has more of this variant than almost any other state, is my understanding.
Yes, that's correct. So we've been particularly concerned about the B117 variant, or what's being called the UK variant, for some time now. It was largely expected to become the dominant strain here in Florida and the U.S. because it's 60% more contagious than the other strains that we've been seeing routinely throughout this epidemic. And in fact, it's 67% more deadly. This B.1.1.7 variant strain is largely what's caused Europe to go into another lockdown, because they have been not as efficient getting vaccines out to their populations across different countries in Europe. They are seeing this fourth wave that's causing lockdowns in Spain, France, Italy, and other countries. So this virus is not going anywhere, and because this B.1.1.7 variant is highly contagious, we are going to see more cases until a younger group starts getting vaccinated more.
Okay, so the race is on then to get people vaccinated, particularly younger Florida residents. Most seniors in the state have gotten at least one dose of the vaccine, right, Chad? The challenge now is to get younger adults to go in and get the shot.
Yes, that's correct. We've largely done a great job vaccinating our older individuals across the state of Florida, and I volunteered at a vaccination site in Nassau County just this past weekend and saw how grateful that older generation was in terms of coming in, getting their vaccine, and being felt like they can move on with life. It was a great event. But it really is about getting the younger individuals vaccinated. Now that 16 and up and 18 and up, depending on the vaccine, can now get shots here in the state of Florida, it's really important we reach that crowd to start boosting that vaccination compliance number amongst those younger generation. We know that that crowd is more likely to throw caution to the wind, so to speak, to go out to restaurants and bars and want to be out there being social. We know it's that crowd, and so it's really important we start getting them vaccinated. Although hospitalizations are still relatively flat here in the Duval metro area, we are seeing slight increases in hospitalizations across the state, and it is a younger crowd that's getting admitted to the hospital. So there is some cause for concern that although the younger folks are less likely to suffer severe disease, if they are getting this B.1.1.7 variant, it still might put them in the hospital.
And, of course, the younger adults are spreading the disease even if they don't get sick. We don't have a mask mandate anymore in Duval County. There's an Ultimate Fighting Championship event coming. It's expected to be at capacity. How concerned are you that too many people are moving on, behaving as though this whole pandemic is over with when it's not?
Yeah, we certainly have some concerns in the public health and epidemiology field that things are opening up a bit too quickly here and there. A good example of that is the Texas Rangers baseball team opening their capacity or their stadium to full capacity just this past weekend. I don't think any public health expert would agree that that was the right move. We certainly want to be cautious, but also we know that there's certain things we can do, particularly if you're fully vaccinated. Outdoor activities in general are going to be very safe versus indoor, and you can see the CDC lessening some restrictions if you're getting vaccinated. And so I think that's some of the encouraging messages we need to put out there, that now is not the right time to celebrate. We need to get more vaccinations out, and as we get vaccinated, that's when we can start feeling more comfortable about these large events.
Let's go to lots of calls now for Chad Nielsen of UF Health Jacksonville, 549-2937. Give us a call. The deadly, highly contagious variant of COVID-19 is the dominant strain of the virus now in Florida. And Florida, along with a handful of other states, has at least half of the cases in the country. So the bottom line, everyone, Florida is still a hot spot for the virus. The pandemic is still active. So please keep masking, distancing, and please go get your vaccine. 549-2937. Courtney in St. John's. Hi, Courtney. Good morning.
Good morning. I just want to say I feel like the federal government has done a really great job with the vaccine rollout. In general, I think most of this comes from our local government, like Ron DeSantis going to the Clay County Fair without a mask, like the whole time, not on the ground, you know, advocating for these vaccines like I feel like he should be. I think that's a big reason why we haven't, because yesterday we were talking about all the vaccines available, you know, at the gate center over there, you know, and they were begging people to come get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Right. Yes, we did have those folks on the air yesterday. Thank you for that, Courtney. Chad, we did learn that Governor DeSantis received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, but he didn't do it publicly, and he took criticism for that, particularly since white Republican men, that's a demographic that is highly resisting getting the vaccine. If the governor had done the vaccination publicly, he would have been setting an example for people who identify with him to go get it. He has downplayed the importance of masking too, to much criticism. So how much of this is on state officials and their tone in the way they've led on this pandemic? Because, you know, it remains a public health crisis in Florida, more so than in many other states.
Yeah, I think in terms of these pandemics and large sort of natural disaster events and whatnot, it really falls upon leadership to set good examples, right? So Dr. Haley, UF Health CEO and an emergency room board physician, was one of the first to receive that vaccine, and he used that platform to reach out across to other demographics and folks to show, look, this is a safe and efficacious vaccine. And that's what leadership really is about. We know that there has to be an end to this pandemic. We know the pathway to get there, and it's incumbent on our state and local leadership to lead the way in terms of showing how to do that. So it's a little discouraging to see some mixed messaging coming from the state, but I think that you have enough local leadership and enough folks like me and the hospitals leadership that are willing to set that right example and help steer the ship.
And what did you think as well about the governor saying the state would ban what are being called vaccine passports or, you know, proof of vaccination to attend an event or to travel and so forth?
Yeah, so there is some tricky legal ground there in terms of requiring vaccine passports, and I think most public health experts would agree on that. It sort of sets up a have and a have not, particularly if vaccinations haven't been equally available to all sectors of the population. Particularly here in Florida, we know that's the case, that urban areas and some lesser served areas have been unable to get the same access to the vaccine as others. And so setting up a vaccine passport, so to speak, does have some ethical and some legal considerations that I think we're not mm-hmm. quite there yet to do. Mm. That being the case, you are seeing some private companies, particularly cruise lines, releasing information saying, look, we're going to start cruising in July, and we're going to require you to be vaccinated. And so it's going to be very interesting to watch how private companies balance this vaccine passport with what the state and federal government say they can do.
Lynn on the South Side. Hi, Lynn. How are you today? Go ahead. Go ahead, Lynn.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just wanted to pipe up on the younger people being vaccinated point. I have four kids aged 17 to 28. And yesterday I was driving up to Atlantic Coast High School, and right next door at Celebration Church, they have a COVID drive-thru, and you don't need an appointment. You can just drive right up. It's for kids age 16 and up, mm-hmm. so adults are, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was no waiting at all. It was super easy. So I wanted to get the word out for people looking. Skinner Parkway, right next door to Atlantic Coast High School, that they have, it's Monday through Saturday from 9 to 4:30 p.m.
Thank you, Lynn. Yeah, you know, Chad, there is no shortage of opportunities to get vaccinated around town. Take your pick. People have no excuse at this point not to go and get it done.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what we intend on, right? We want to have enough vaccine to distribute freely to anyone who wants to come up and get it. And so it's great to hear that at least one side out there is processing people at the beaches very quickly. We need to allow people time to do that. So certainly here in our organization and other hospitals, we've allowed people to take time off to do things like take their kids to get their vaccines or get their vaccines themselves. And I think something like that, you're going to see more and more frequently. University of Florida has been doing a great job with the Florida Department of Health in Alachua County doing vaccinations amongst their students. And so allowing class time off to go get their vaccines and things of that nature are really helping to boost us getting the vaccine into this younger crowd.
549-2937, Joe in Riverside. Hi, Joe. Good morning. Hey,
Good
Joe.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking
sure,
my
go ahead.
Call. I have a question for Dr. Chad regarding the effectiveness of these vaccines. Are we addressing the root cause of these zoonotic pandemics coming from animal slaughter, especially when Russia is warning of a new strain, H5N8, coming from birds in the poultry farm?
Okay. Yeah, you know, Chad, you've talked about this on the show before. The virus did originate in Wuhan, China, from a wet animal market. Let's talk about that for a minute. because, of course, our big priority is just getting through this thing. But every time we talk about the origin of the virus, we do get calls from people asking us to take a moment to consider that our habits, our way of life, particularly our carnivorous way of life, is not good for the planet and not good for us overall.
Yeah, so there's a whole arm of public health and science that deals with this concept. It's called One Health. And so it deals with how we interact with our environment, whether that's the food chain or agricultural, and how that affects our health and well-being of not just us, but animals and the environment. And so certainly the World Health Organization, the CDC, and other governments are investigating where exactly the COVID-19 virus came from. And current thinking is that it originated from an animal vector, and it jumped into the human chain somewhere in a wet market in Wuhan. But the base of it is that we may never have a pinpoint of where this virus came from. And that's not unusual in virology, that we don't have an actual origin story for something. It's extremely difficult to investigate where viruses come from, how they evolve. And so that gets complicated depending on what country it originated from or what those rules are and getting in there. It took us decades to figure out where Ebola came from and the other hemorrhagic viruses. So what is incumbent upon us is to continue pushing science forward, have a better understanding of how viruses jump from animals to humans, and how our impacts on the environment affect that. And we know in some areas, particularly in South America and in Africa, deforestation and those sorts of activities drive animals to interact more with humans, which could trigger some kind of virus events. And so it's a very important study that continues to this day.
Roland is on the line in Fernandina Beach. Hey, Roland, how are you? Good morning.
Good. The comment I just wanted to make is, it's like with our vaccinations and what we've got going on, we've got the momentum to win this, to beat this virus. And the thing is that with so many states trying to lift mask mandates and do this, you know, it's like they're spiking the ball at the 10-yard line. Mm. It's like, wait a minute. Are you going to send this thing into overtime? You know, this, we can win. We can beat this. We can beat this virus. We're on a roll. Let's keep the momentum going. But no, okay, no. Let's go ahead and open everything up. You don't need masks. You know, we don't need to send this virus into overtime. It's a sad, you know, come on, man, we're winning.
We need to end this and not fumble at the goal line, Roland. I think you're absolutely right. And so, Chad, you know, it's human nature. We've been at this thing for over a year. Everybody's tired. Everybody's sick of wearing masks. Everybody just wants to go back to what they knew before the pandemic. But I know it's frustrating, but, you know, on this program, we routinely try to get the message out through experts like you that we have to be vigilant for a while longer. It's hard to get that message through, but we have to keep trying, don't we?
Yes, absolutely. And the caller was right. I think you're seeing a lot of people spiking the ball, metaphorically, at the 10-yard line. And that's obviously not going to help us get to the end of this pandemic. We will get there. I want people to rest assured we will vaccinate. People will get vaccinations. We will see case numbers fall. And we will get through this pandemic. But how governments are responding to this at the state and community levels are going to determine whether or not, as the caller said, we go to overtime on this or not. I think you're starting to see corporations step up to the plate a little bit more. Budweiser recently put out a public service announcement, a commercial, speaking to this very issue that, hey, we're doing great, we're almost there, but we're not there yet. And I think as you see corporate America shift that, particularly companies who are trying to sell us something to get back to normal, I think you're going to start seeing a change in the population in responding to this better. But unfortunately, we live in a time now where everything is politicized, and unfortunately, that hurts science and that hurts our public health efforts.
Yeah. Let me clarify a comment I made a moment ago. The World Health Organization report states that they don't believe the virus originated in a wet market in Wuhan, China, but most likely originated in livestock farms. Let me just correct that. Here's a tweet from a listener. He asks you, Chad, how virulent are the variants compared to the original virus?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And so far what we know, particularly with B.1.1.7, is that it is more virulent, it is more contagious, and it causes more severe and more deadly cases. And several research studies are now being released on that because this B.1.1.7 British variant has been around now since the fall. We know a lot about it. And so it's definitely a variant that we have to be concerned about. In terms of causing more severe disease, the South African and the Brazilian variants, although they have different mechanisms that might allow for more severe cases, they're not being seen as virulent or as problematic as the British B.1.1.7 variant.
Here's another tweet for you. I'm worried about kids getting the variant. How soon can kids ages 5 to 15 get vaccinated? Which vaccine will they be given?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We know that both Moderna and Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson, all three, are testing their vaccines on children. In fact, Pfizer released data, I believe it was last week, showing efficacy data in 12 to 15-year-olds that are under study right now, and that data indicated that amongst that 12 to 15-year-old group that Pfizer has been trialing the vaccine on, none of them got symptomatic COVID over a four-month period. So we know that the major manufacturers and the major pharmaceutical companies are working on getting this vaccine out to kids, but they have to go through robust safety trials and robust safety data in order to prove to the FDA and the CDC that the vaccines are not only efficacious but safe, and they're in process. Mm-hmm. We don't have a timeline yet for when that could be released, but I would be surprised if we didn't have vaccines approved for another group of younger individuals by this fall.
It can't come soon enough for some families. As I've mentioned on the air before, a close friend and coworker of mine has a son who has what amounts to long-haul COVID-19, and he's only 12. And what they've found, it seems, is that the vaccine improves the prognosis for people with long COVID, and that includes kids. It's a small population, but they are suffering.
Yeah, undeniably. We know that there's been pediatric deaths here in the state of Florida. Not many, but we have had them, and that's unfortunate. So we know that this affects a lot of people, and that's why we have to be very vigilant about how fast we can get this vaccine out to those younger kids who are in schools and who we're seeing are spreading it, particularly in that college-age crowd. So I think we just have to be very vigilant. Parents, I'm a parent myself. My four-year-old daughter goes to preschool, and you know, the last thing I want is for her to get COVID. And so that's why it's really incumbent that the rest of us get vaccinated, much like we were protecting the elderly by masking and by social distancing before they could get vaccinated. We need to start putting that stuff back in place in terms of getting vaccinations in order to ensure our kids mm-hmm. aren't going to get COVID and suffer from it.
Sue emails the show, I believe it's short-sighted for the governor to oppose vaccine passports. We might need them in other states. We can have access to them without requiring businesses to enforce, and then each business can decide how best to protect their clients, she says. Let's take one more call. It is Sherry in Fernandina Beach. Hi, Sherry. Good morning to you.
Hi. I have an
friend. Speak up a little, Sherry. Sorry, having trouble hearing you.
Okay. Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I have a college student from out of state, a friend of the family who's living with us while she goes to school online. So she does not have a Florida ID. She wants to get vaccinated, and we're not quite sure what to do.
Okay, thanks for that. Chad Nielsen, your advice for Sherry and her friend.
Yeah, I would attempt to take them to take the student to a vaccination site. I know that there's some ID requirements, but anecdotally, what we're hearing is we're giving these vaccines out at these sites to basically anyone who comes up. So I would say go ahead, take them to a vaccination site with whatever ID they do have, and let's see where that falls. Soon enough, we're going to be moving the vaccines out to more and more clinical providers, pediatric offices, and just in general doctor's offices over the next few months. So if the student can't get vaccinated now because of an ID issue, I would think that it would be very soon able to get vaccinated in a doctor's office. But I would say at this point, go ahead and try. It's worth it.
Worth a shot. No pun intended. Chad, yeah. Thank you so much. Chad Nielsen. He's Director of Accreditation and Infection Prevention at UF Health Jacksonville. So good to have you on again. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Melissa. It's always a pleasure.
Much more still ahead. Later, it's a conversation with First Coast author Michael Wiley on his new thriller, plus the return of local think tank JCCI. But up next, all about this weekend's Fair Housing Symposium. You have rights. We'll tell you what they are next. Well, in this pandemic, housing has become a huge concern. If you're at risk of eviction because you can't pay your rent in these challenging times, the city is trying to let you know you have rights. Wendy Binloss is Executive Director of the Jacksonville Human Rights Commission, and she spoke with me earlier this week to tell us all about the upcoming Fair Housing Symposium they're holding in Jacksonville this weekend. Hi, Wendy. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And this is such a timely topic because, of course, with the pandemic and the recession, you know, we have seen people struggle so terribly to pay their rent, to make ends meet. So tell us about the Jacksonville Human Rights Commission's annual Fair Housing Symposium coming up this weekend.
Yes, Melissa. April is National Fair Housing Month. And every year we join with HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and other agencies around the country to plan special activities in April to recognize National Fair Housing Month and to renew our commitment to equality in housing. So in partnership with JALA, Jacksonville Area Legal Aid, we sponsor a Fair Housing Symposium and invite the community to attend so they can learn more about their fair housing rights. And that is what is taking place this Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Okay. People don't always know their rights, correct? They don't know what the law might say and how they can be protected from eviction.
Absolutely. And there are you know, a lot of additional housing issues due to COVID-19, and a lot of people have lost their jobs. So we want to make sure that they know what their rights are, and that's the purpose of the symposium.
What would be the most common example of what you're seeing right now, where people need to be educated on something that has to do with their housing? Give me an example.
Well, the theme of this year's symposium is Fair Housing, Safe, Accessible, and Free of Harassment. So basically, the commission, this theme is that the commission feels like every person has the right to feel safe in their home, to have an accessible home if they have a disability and to be free of any type of harassment. We have all heard that expression, there's no place like home. So everyone has the right to have a safe, welcoming home, regardless of their race, gender, or any other factor. One of the issues we see most prevalently is disability issues. Persons who need a reasonable accommodation or modification in their home or their apartment so that it is accessible and they feel safe. So that's a common issue. Another issue that has recently increased is harassment in housing, particularly sexual harassment. And so, again, the idea is that people should be safe in their home. And especially with so much job insecurity and housing insecurity, some people may feel that they have no choice to submit to something like that, which is illegal behavior and totally inappropriate, in order to keep their home. And they don't. And so we want to make sure that they are informed of their rights and know what their options are and how they can protect themselves.
And can you talk a little bit about the role of the Human Rights Commission in acting as a watchdog in these kinds of situations?
Yes. We, of course, have a whole complaint system. We work closely with HUD to monitor any issues that in this area, in Jacksonville, Duval County. And we look for these issues where there's maybe systemic problems or widespread housing violations. And those are the type of issues we want to make sure are addressed in our Fair Housing Symposium and other ways that we reach out to the public and to educate them.
So with all of that said, how can people be part of the event? Tell us all the registration details.
Yes. So the symposium is scheduled for Saturday, April 10th from 10 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the main public library downtown. And people have to pre-register. They can pre-register by going on the city's or JHRC, the commission's website, and Facebook pages. All the information will be there.
Check it out, everyone. This Saturday's Fair Housing Symposium, kicking off at 10 a.m. downtown at the Jacksonville Main Library. And I want to thank you so much for your time, Wendy. Wendy Binloss, Executive Director of the Jacksonville Human Rights Commission. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Melissa.
Well, after a five-year hiatus, this city's influential think tank, JCCI, or Jacksonville Community Council, Inc., they're back in operation. That is good news for this region. The new board chair of JCCI, Ramon Day, is on the line to tell us how this has all come about. Hey, Ramon, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. It's Raymond.
Raymond, so sorry. That is...
That's okay. Not a problem.
I am so sorry. Raymond. Okay, so Raymond, tell us how this happened, because when JCCI shut its doors 5 years ago, that was really bad news, because over the years, JCCI has been so influential in driving community discussions about the biggest issues affecting this region and nudging policymakers and businesses to take action on them. So how did JCCI come back to life?
Well, first of all, thank you for this opportunity to share the events of the last few weeks and how we are here today. The Times Union ran an editorial on Monday, February 22nd, and lamenting the demise of JCCI, calling for, I believe they used the term, resurrection. And there was a lot of chatter on Facebook and maybe other social media platforms. And that continued throughout Monday afternoon, evening, and into the following morning on Tuesday the 23rd. So I kept seeing the comments, and I made a few positive comments about the great things that it did. And around shortly after lunch, I just kept seeing more positive comments. So I kind of piqued my curiosity. So I went on the Division of Corporations website, and the entity was sitting out there in inactive status. So I just, you know, entered in the template to file articles of incorporation. And I received a notice on Thursday that everything had been approved. And I went on to a site for grabbing domains, and JacksonvilleCommunityCouncil.org was available. So I obtained that domain name. And so, you know, I made a post that, you know, what I had done, and got a lot of positive feedback. And so over the weekend, I kept thinking about, you know, what needed to be done. So Tuesday, I made a telephone call to my friend J.F. Bryan IV. And J.F. is, you know, the epitome of civic leadership in this city. And he was a former board chair, a long time board chair person, and a long time board member. So he said he was glad to know what I had done, and I asked him if he would be willing to serve on a new board. He agreed. So I told him we would get back together soon. So, you know, a lot of the people who would make comments after I posted about the reactivation said, hey, let me know what I can do to help. And so I just went through and picked out some of those individuals. I emailed everybody that had posted a comment or instant messaged them on Facebook, and then asked for their email addresses. Some of them I got back. And so I just randomly selected a couple of people that seemed to have, you know, an interest and compatible backgrounds. Then asked them for referrals of people that would fit in a board role, making sure that it reflected the diversity of the city. And here we are. We had our first board meeting Tuesday.
And you're the chair, and I'm looking at the names of the board members. You do have a really nice, diverse board, which is great to see. Looks much more like this community than a lot of boards I could name. So, but let me ask you, Raymond, JCCI shut down originally because of funding problems. So what's the plan to fund think tank studies and operations going forward?
Well, this is a journey of faith. We are confident that people believe in the purpose of JCCI. They believe in the mission, and it will simply be a matter of putting together a development strategy to raise the funding on a sustainable basis. You know, primarily driven out of the philanthropic community, to make sure that there's this solid commitment, and that we aren't left up to, you know, the vagaries of the city funding that has to go through the annual appropriations process. So just making sure that, you know, solid support out of the private sector, and then we're able to take that support and then convert that into, you know, grassroots community effort. And it's all about community engagement. So if we can have the financial foundation, we can engage the community and return to the focus on, you know, studying the problems that are facing this city.
And what problems do you think JCCI will take up next?
We are looking long term, and so just as an example, in September, the census numbers will come out, and we're probably going to be looking at the very first time a city of over a million people. And I'm not talking about the MSA. I'm talking about Duval County, over 1 million people. And with the kind of growth rate that has brought us to this level in the last 2 to 4 years, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that in 30 or 40 years, this is a city of 2 million people. So just think about the problems we face today with a doubled population, and those will begin to put things into perspective. a number of different study topics have been thrown around. Homelessness, affordable housing, one topic suggested was a study of race relations. Another topic is city finances. There was a very in-depth report done in 2010. In fact, I believe JF was the chair of that study. And they dug heavily into city finances. And with the recent sales tax, half-cent sales tax, passed for schools and the proposed 6 cent a gallon increase in the gasoline tax, many people argue the ad valorem tax rate is artificially low, that there should be some other enhanced revenue sources. So then that's a topic that could, it could take well over a year to analyze.
And you've got a
topic.
You've got a board. Do you plan to soon hire a new CEO?
Well, as soon as the funding is in place, mm-hmm. The idea would be to put together a top-notch professional staff and use the staff to carry on the mission of JCCI.
And JCCI was actually housed here in our building at WJCT Public Media before they stopped operating. Do you plan
to
come?
That's correct.
Do you plan to come back here or go somewhere else?
Well, if the space were to be offered in a nice, affordable price range, I think it would be an excellent location. My personal preference is to have the offices located somewhere in the downtown area.
Right.
But, I'm just one person on the board.
Sure. We have a number of nonprofits here. People might not realize that. It would be great to have you back. Of course, that's not my call, but it is good to talk to you about this. It's good news for the community. Can you direct everyone again to your new website?
Yes. Now, this is under construction. However, it is simply jacksonvillecommunitycouncil.org. jacksonvillecommunitycouncil.org. We have the domain. The website is under construction. And it will have the ability to volunteer. It will have the ability to donate and support financially the mission of JCCI. And it will be the primary means for keeping our citizens informed about the activities of JCCI.
All right. He's Raymond Day, the new board chair of JCCI. Back to life. Raymond, thank you so much.
Thanks, Melissa. Have a nice day.
You too. Well, have you been reading more in the pandemic? Are you in the market for a new good book? Still to come, First Coast author Michael Wiley is back with a new thriller. We'll talk to him about Headcase. That's next. You're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. Don't go away.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
Solar Energy Labs, dedicated to providing the latest technology for harvesting clean energy from the sun. Systems offered carry a 25-year warranty with equipment made in the USA. Choose energy for a changing world. Information at GoSolarJax.com.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. On her new album, Rhiannon Giddens turns to traditional songs and laments for comfort in these difficult times.
What I think it does is it kind of releases some of those feelings that you have. You kind of experience them through the song, and then at the end, you're a little bit lighter.
We'll speak with her next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Twyla Tharp, one of the most acclaimed and innovative dancers and choreographers of our time. Her choreography demands incredible flexibility, speed, power, and stamina, and draws from ballet, modern dance, tap, vaudeville, and everyday movement. She's the subject of the latest PBS American Masters documentary. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
4 out of 5 Americans live in a state where it's illegal for a doctor to help a terminally ill patient die. Broadcaster Diane Rehm is an advocate for the Death with Dignity movement. In her new documentary, she speaks to those who agree with her and those who don't.
It's one thing to say, you know, my quality of life is diminishing. It's another thing to step in and to take over the process.
Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville author Michael Wiley is building a national reputation with riveting novels that have a criminal element feel. The stories are told both here in Jacksonville and in his hometown of Chicago. I spoke with Wiley about his new book, Head Case.
Michael Wiley, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be back, Melissa.
You're such a prolific author, and we're so glad to claim you here on the First Coast. I'm excited to see that your new novel, Head Case, is getting great early buzz. I'm quoting here from a starred review in Publishers Weekly, calling it an outstanding mystery. So right out of the gate, this book is getting some positive talk. Tell us about Head Case.
Yeah, it's the kind of talk I like.
Yeah, sure. Beats the alternative.
In this story, private detective Sam Kelson, as usual, he tends to get himself into situations that bang him up a lot. And he's in the hospital recovering from his latest situation when a nurse approaches. The nurse says that 3 patients have died, a teenage boy, a woman in her 70s, and a homeless man. They're different people who've died from different causes, but the nurse thinks that their deaths are suspicious and related. The nurse turns out to be right, and off we go.
So you have done a few books around this character of Sam Kelson, a Chicago private investigator, and he is a guy who, correct me if I'm wrong, he used to be a cop, and then like a lot of ex-cops, he does this kind of PI work. This is a kind of a familiar character in literature. What is it about Sam that makes him memorable and interesting?
He's pretty frequently noted in pretty much all the reviews and by all the readers as being, even though he's somebody we recognize the kind of detective he is distinct, he's unique. He suffers from disinhibition, from one of those bang-ups, and so he can't help but to speak the truth and to speak in all the times when he should keep his mouth shut. That means lots of tension. It means some good humor along the way. You know, I like to think of him as the most deeply human, deeply, sympathetic character I can imagine.
And this series of Sam Kelson mysteries that you've been turning out over the years has really built a fan base. You write a lot about this guy in Chicago while living here in Jacksonville, Florida, because you're like me and a lot of other people. You've left Chicago physically, but not really in your head, right?
It's hard to get Chicago out of your head.
Yeah, yeah. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, you know, it's maybe it's those cold winters that they freeze apart and never quite thaws. But it's, you know, I write about both Chicago and the Jacksonville area. I have 4 books that I have set here. And I love to write about this area, and the latest work that I'm working on, again, returns me here and returns my characters here. You know, Chicago, though, every now and then, you know, it's you know, in the middle of a hot summer when we're all wishing that we could maybe take a little break. Mentally, I like to get back there, too. And so I started writing this series. And as you say, you know, I've been fortunate that it's been a real success with readers and really has developed something of a fan base. And so I've kept on returning. You know, I've kept on returning. But again, after a few cold winters there, it's time to get back here, too.
Sure. Now, you're publishing your newest, in, as we're still in the midst of pandemic, so are you doing virtual book signings? Tell us about how people can interact with you about the new book, Headcase.
Right. It's a mix. You know, I'm doing a fair amount of media, but I'm also doing, you know, a good number of virtual events. I was officially in Orlando at the Orlando Book Festival over the weekend. I am going to be doing an in-person event, if circumstances allow, at San Marco Bookstore on April 29th. That's a Thursday evening. We'll see whether the circumstances allow, but if we do it, it will be with lots of social distancing. Yes, we're still in the middle of it. This is actually my second pandemic book, and it's not a great time to be releasing, but on the other hand, it's a wonderful time to be reading.
That's right. I would think the demand for your books is greater than ever right now. People are looking for good books.
The book market has been a very interesting thing to watch right now. It's you know, there are certain kind of industries that have done well, grocery stores. I think if you invested in, say, Netflix, you're probably, you know, ready to retire now. And Zoom. But yes, the book market has been nice.
Good for you. Michael Wiley, Jacksonville's own prolific author, pick up his new Sam Kelson mystery. It's out now. It's called Headcase. Congrats, Michael.
Thanks, Melissa. Wonderful to talk with you as always.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, news director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortzfeld. Keep sending your feedback to us. We appreciate it. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, our podcast will be up later today, wherever you like to listen, or you can always listen through our WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Talk to you then, and have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.